At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hey, everybody. JJ Cooper here. Another Baseball America podcast. A special one today. One I'm very excited to do. We're going to talk pitching. We're going to talk pitching injuries. And I think most importantly, we're going to talk about returning to play after a significant injury, a Tommy John surgery, elbow injury, and things like that. And to do that, I am joined today by Randy Sullivan, CEO of the Florida Baseball Armory, and Alan Jaeger, the founder of Jaeger Sports. Two guys who I've known Alan for more years than I would like to admit, but two people who have been spending time working on this. And I would say, like, again, from the goal of keeping pitchers healthy, getting pitchers back to where they need to be. And so we're going to have kind of a free-form discussion of this. I think I've said that before when I've had you on the podcast, Alan, where we're going to talk about this. And really, I'm going to let you guys talk more than anything, because that's why you guys are on here. So, but to kind of start that off, so Randy, I'll start with you. Kind of, if you would, just for our listeners, explain kind of how you got to this point and why this is, this kind of has grabbed you, again, not just pitching development, but also trying to, pit injury prevention and return from injury.
Yeah. So, well, I've been a physical therapist for now, probably 31 years, I guess. So I started out in that world, morphed into the baseball world. I was coaching baseball. A lot of kids that I was coaching in the travel ball industry would get injured and come to our physical therapy practice. And it all kind of began. My own son needed to throw harder to get recruited to play college baseball. And, back then everyone said it was impossible to teach. And I thought, it's a movement. If I can teach someone who just had a stroke to walk, we might be able to squeeze a couple miles an hour out of a pitcher. And so it started out in that regard. And then our practice morphed into just a bunch of baseball players. And in 2020, we actually shut down our physical therapy practice because we got so busy training baseball players. And so that medical background has really been sort of the angle that we've always taken, the anatomy, how does the body really work? And also being able to blend it with, 20 years or 30 years experience coaching baseball players. And I've kind of always been in both worlds. I was a former player myself. I went to a school called the Citadel, Military College of South Carolina, played there, learned a lot about the game, and this, loved it ever since and stayed in it. And so it kind of morphed into this thing. And then I met Alan. And we've had these, it's probably been about 6 or 7 years now. I'm kind of known as night guy. I don't sleep much, right? So I'm on the East Coast, but I have a lot of West Coast friends because they're up. There's somebody to talk to. And so Alan and I have had these long, long, deep conversations. You don't get into a conversation with Alan Jaeger without getting deep. You never stay on the surface. And it kind of we began to look at this return to throwing protocol and how the same one has been handed out over the years and passed down from generation to generation. And then this, our annual spring epidemic happened, our annual spring training epidemic, where this time a bunch of big name players went down. And so we began to talk a lot about, like, what are we doing wrong as an industry? And we really have had some deep conversations about path dependency. Like, we kept going down the same route. Like, the same experts are guiding us in the same direction, and we keep trying to same the solve problems with a little twist on the same angle of approach. And I think maybe we need a whole different way to look at things and a new paradigm to look at how we train, how we prepare players, how we condition them, how we get them ready. I think Alan will talk a lot about how I think that our aversion to stress, we don't want to add stress, we want to protect them, has maybe contributed to the problem of making them a little more fragile than they need to be. We think that maybe you got to make them a little bit, make the tissue a little bit tougher, get it more robust, get it more resilient, able to withstand the inevitable stresses of throwing. And so we got together and we started looking at this return to throwing protocol and realized it needed to be overhauled. And Alan put in hours and hours and hours of work and coordination, long discussions with a lot of people, and put this thing together. And he's such a powerful force in the industry because he's such a positive influencer, and everybody that comes into contact with his aura feels the compassion and the genuine concern and the genuine love for other people. And he's just so well renowned that he was the one guy that could bring all the forces together to make it all happen, to start to instigate some change. So I'm pleased, honored to be on here with you, and thrilled to be associated with that dude at the bottom of the screen right there.
Well, Alan, that's about as good an introduction as you're going to get, but I'll ask you kind of the same question. You know, I would say that some people in the industry think of you as Mr. Long Toss. I think others think of you as basically for the mental preparation side and that, but kind of what has, if you could in a short form, kind of explain to people who don't know, you know, who may be listening to this and haven't come across you before, kind of what your background is and what has led you to this point.
Yeah, well, first of all, I just have to say thank you to Randy, because Randy has been an incredible teacher to me. And I want to thank you, JJ, because this is a huge deal and we just appreciate you having us on. I started out ironically in the mental game because I went through a very difficult time at Cal State Northridge as a pitcher, and had no idea what had happened and didn't have any tools. And so I saw a sports psychologist, and long story short, I got heavily involved in Zen and Eastern philosophy and meditation and yoga. And so I wrote a book back in the 90s on that topic. And on the side, it sounds funny, but I started getting lessons and I became a pitching coach at LA Mission Junior College and did that for 3 or 4 years, 3 years total. And then, I just started merging together the idea of the mental game and being a pitching coach. But the thing I started specializing in, I just had a love for throwing since I was young. I threw a lot. I threw anything I could get my hands on. I think that's one of the reasons I had a rubber arm, strong, healthy arm. And it really wasn't until 1997 when I went to spring training and one of our kids was basically, who was training with us in the off season. We used to have an 8-week pro off season program, and they were lining up these cones. And I thought they were lining up the cones to run the 60. So he was training with us, and this kid had a big arm, high pick. He was probably 330 plus as far as distance wise. And they capped him at 120 feet. And it was also timed. It was like 10 minutes. I couldn't believe it. This kid was a freaking beast. You know, he left our camp in what we call beast mode. And so that was sort of the major lightning bolt in my world, where all of a sudden I started realizing that there was restrictions, and which is funny, it's leading to our talk today, but there is restrictions and constrictions and kind of a cookie cutter approach. And I had never even heard of a throwing program in my life until that point, because everything I did and I was around was very instinctive, very feel-based, very progressive buildup. So long story short is that's what kind of got me here, is I've kind of merged the mental and physical. But specifically to today's topic is, as you know, JJ, I mean, I've been pushing long toss and really individuality and athleticism for a really long time. And so the same principles really that apply to the healthy population was the same problems that were happening with the rehab population. And that's when I reached out to Randy, because after 20 years of getting very similar feedback from countless players and countless coaches about the standardized return to throwing And honestly, the limitations and just feeling like players were put in a more compromised position. I called Randy and I said, "Hey, man, this has just been going on too long, and so let's put something together." And I feel very fortunate because Randy to me is a rare breed where you have the person that truly understands the science, the medical, the biomechanics, but has an unbelievable feel for the nature of the athlete and the nature of how the body works.
So that kind of leads into our topic today. Before we dive into return to pitch and all that, I do want to get kind of, I'll start with you, Alan, this time. Like, obviously we are in, I feel like we kind of are at this point most years, which is we get to March, we get to April, and the elbow injuries arise. Because we do know, like, and again, if you all disagree, please let me know, but this is the danger period most of the time for pitchers, in that ramp up, the time from when a pitcher basically arrives to a team to the point where he's fully stretched out is often the time where we see not the, you know, preponderance, but we see a higher injury risk than we do in season. Not that they don't still occur, but we see an inflection point. We've seen it again this year, obviously. And I think what we've seen this year most notably is that the quality of the names, right? The starters who have had elbow injuries kind of leads us to even the industry to even more concern about it, because we're seeing Cy Young winners. We're seeing so many of the best pitchers in baseball right now who are either sidelined or already have had or just had Tommy John surgery in recent months. But kind of to you, Alan, to kind of start with is there's a part of me that feels like that this is kind of it's a problem we're always going to have in some ways. Like the shoulder injury epidemic was thankfully something that could be somewhat improved, because I would say if you look over the last 20 years, if you look 20 years ago, there was not an understanding of shoulder strengthening protocols, ways to improve the kind of the your a pitcher's musculature and improve everything they needed to kind of help strengthen that area. And at the end of the day, we have pitchers now, not that there aren't delivery improvements, not that there aren't strengthening the muscles around the ligament, but at the end of the day, a UCL ligament is kind of the weak link of this whole pitching process. And you can't strengthen a ligament. You can help it heal after an injury, things like that. But again, do either of y'all disagree with that? Like, the thing that strikes me is not that we want to improve them, but at the same time, elbow injuries are something that are always going to be a factor in a sport where throwing 100 makes you probably more successful than throwing 85, but also we know increases the stress on your elbow. Is there anything I've said there, Alan, that strikes you as this? No, that's a poor summary there, or does that all fit with what kind of conventional wisdom, I guess I should say, or at least acceptable wisdom? Because I don't know, conventional wisdom's not always your thing, but accepted wisdom.
Well, Randy's going to talk in a second on the physiology of the actual ligament and some really good stuff about that. I would say this: you could say that elbow injuries, you know, with overhand throwing athletes, so to speak, you can understand that there's elbow injuries. But our concern, and everybody in the baseball industry is concerned, is that it doesn't have to be nearly the rates that are. I mean, to me, this is completely unnecessary. It's beyond comprehension how bad it's got, and it doesn't need to be where it's at. So the first thing I'll say is this: as far as the April, March, April, May, number one, I was talking to someone the other day, and who's with one of the major league organizations, and he made a great point, which is, you know, in the off season, I actually have written a 5-month slow build progression offseason for professionals from the day the season ends, including deloading and resting and active rest and buildup. It's a beautiful rhythm. And his point was that professional athletes now, especially with all the metrics in Rapsodo, is they, not that they don't rest after the season, but, you know, there's excitement in this idea of, you know, I can get my spin rate up on, you know, on my vertical break, or right? And there's measurements, and then you can beat those measurements. So a lot of the offseason, these pitchers are probably making a lot of high exertion, high intent throws. There's not a lot of breaks. So that's something that's sort of a given. That's a problem. But the other problem I have is this. I think for players that have worked with us, worked with Randy, worked with Eric Cressy, Ron Wolford, Tread Athletics, Driveline, I get the feeling that they have progressions that are really smart and in place. But here's the issue. Now you show up to spring training, and I'm not going to point fingers at any one team, but if right now, and Randy's going to talk about doubling down here in a second, but right now, our world for the last 20 to 25 years has been based around the narrative of pitch counts, innings limitation, workload management, counting throws. So that's the psychology, right, of a lot of these organizations that to me, when you show up as a pitcher, you could be in the best shape of your life. If all of a sudden now you start, I have a saying, which is, you know, you start getting the durability sucked out of you. Right. If you, I, another word I love is deconditioning. And what I feel like happens, JJ, is they get to spring training and now all of a sudden they're monitored and they're managed. And to me, it's like, I was thinking about this earlier today. You know, if someone said to you, define love or define intuition, you know, you can go through, you could go on forever. You'll never get to the experience or feeling of it. And to me, I feel like these athletes, this is an experience and a feeling. And then we're trying to define it and put it in a box and protect it. And right. And so now all of a sudden, these athletes are, they, it's almost like they hit the brakes. And now they're in spring training. Now they're in monitor mode. Right. Now they're in pitch count mode, innings mode, workload management mode. Throws are being counted. This has nothing to do with, I mean, I know it sounds good in science and data, but this is the part of doubling down. We keep doing the same thing. And to me, no. This is about allowing the athlete to grow and evolve and develop. And Randy will talk about, you know, adding stress the smart way. So I'll end by saying this, that to me, we need to figure out how to first of all, we need to figure out how for these athletes to have a better off season where they're working on endurance and volume and recovery and all sorts of good things like that. And there needs to be a transition to spring training now where we need to start figuring this out, that these players need to be built up and they need to be sort of individualized and freed up to where they can get healthier and stronger rather than putting them in a box.
Randy, I'm going to follow up that with you. And again, also with the biomechanics and all of it, but to kind of tie off of what Alan said, one of the things I'm working on right now for a piece is what struck me just was a Slack conversation we were having among the staff yesterday. And one of our staffers asked, he said, I wonder who's got the longest streak of 100 plus pro innings per year. You know, who has the longest streak? And 2020 obviously makes this a little bit more complicated. Got to throw that one out because 2020 shortened season, all that, no minor league season. But Zach Greinke, unfortunately, may end this year, but Zach Greinke has thrown 100 plus innings every year other than 2020, 100 pro innings every year since 2003, which is an amazing durability. And then you say, okay, what about 150 innings? 150 is even a heavier workload. And Max Scherzer has done that for, I believe, if I'm not looking at the number in front of you, I believe it's 15 seasons now. So those are the kind of durabilities that we, you know, that we want to see. That's the goal for a pro pitcher. But the question I kind of have with that is, and maybe it's a leading question. I might be leading the witness here a little bit, but we are now, the thing that strikes me is when I started at Baseball America, when you all were getting involved in this, I would say that we were still in what could be defined in some ways as the pitcher abuse era, right? That there were pitchers who, not everyone could be Nolan Ryan, but right. You know, if you go back to the 70s, what you did is you treated everyone like Nolan Ryan, and we found that Nolan Ryan was able to throw 170 pitches and then get the ball again 5 days later. But Frank Tanana might not be able to do that and throw a 95 and all that. And even if you get to the start of the 21st century, 2001, 2002, you know, we would have times where the example I always like to use is Kenny Baugh was at Rice, and Kenny Baugh threw like 110 pitches on the opener of the regional. Then they brought him back on short rest to throw 130. Then he threw 179 on the first outing of the super regional. Diddy was a first round pick, and then the Tigers got him and said, hey, we're going to send you out for another 60 innings. You know, so, and there were times where pitchers would get hurt back then, maybe because they were overused. But we're probably now, when it comes to pro baseball, I would say, I feel like that's a generation plus ago, where we don't have anyone in pro baseball now who blows out their arm because they're a starter who just gets overused. And again, this is the leading question, but what strikes me is but I can't point you to the example of the pitcher who has come up in the new era, right? The pitcher who came into pro ball, Dylan Bundy, one of the best high school pitching prospects of the 21st century, goes into pro ball, and the plan is we don't care how you pitch today, you're going to go three innings today, the next outing you're going to go three, the next outing you're going to go three. And Dylan Bundy didn't give up a hit, I think, until his fourth outing. And in, I think, fifth outing, it's like, okay, now we're going to let you go four. And the struggle I have with is that's been going on. That's 2012. There have been pitchers kind of brought up through that era for now 10-plus years. And I can't come up with the example of the pitcher who came through that pathway and is now the most durable pitcher, you know, one of the most durable pitchers in baseball. The most durable pitchers we have seem to be the pitchers who came from a different approach. Now, again, that's as you all talk about this and you all look at this, does that kind of fit with what you all are seeing, or is there, you know, is there a gradation there that I'm missing that I don't feel like, I feel like that what we're doing now, that there's a lot of pitch count reduction for well-meaning. Everyone in this is trying to prevent injuries, but I just don't know how much it's preventing any injuries.
Agree. Yeah. So that's a lot to unwrap, but you're right. It is. So back in 2014, I looked at some articles that I wrote back in 2014. We had a bunch of guys go down. Medlin, Jose Fernandez, Beachy, Corbin, all in the same spring, you know, and it was an epidemic. It was a panic and the sky's falling. And back then, when you went to the experts, we had studies that showed that, you know, the UCL can only take 35 newton meters of torque. And it tears at that, and you have to accept 70 newton meters on a pitch. And so it doesn't match. It should tear on every pitch, right? And so we kind of thought, okay, it must be a workload issue. It must be a volume of throwing issue, right? That's what we said. If you throw more than this many pitches or more than this many innings, you're going to break, right? Well, first, the problem is one-size-fits-all approach there. Like, there are some guys that could throw a lot, right? And it's way deeper than just how many throws. It's like how you make those throws. It comes down to your physical structure, your hardware, how you're made. Some that we can change and some we can't. Some you're just born with, right? And then it comes down to your movement pattern, your mechanics, people call it, like how you move, which needs to match the way you're made. And then it comes down to your ramp up, the gradual introduction of stress to the system. You got to have stress, you know? You mentioned that you can't make a ligament tougher or something like that. It can't. Well, the fact is you can. It's alive. It's a living tissue. And there's a law in physiology called Davis's law that says that every tissue in the human body adapts to react to the stresses that you place upon it. So if we remove stress, we make it more fragile. If we add stress, we make it tougher. Okay. But the key is we gotta add that stress incrementally, gradually. You have to ramp it up over time. You can't just go hard at it right away. It also comes down to your strength and conditioning programs, your long toss, your weighted balls, your preparation, the conditioning programs to get your whole body ready. And then it's nutrition, sleep, hydration, psychological stress. And then there's workload, right? And if the first five are good, you can throw a lot, right? If the first five are bad, 15 pitches might be too much for you. And so we put this arbitrary line to say, don't go over this many pitches or this many innings. And we created what I read one author say was the cult of average, where everybody's on this line. And we have some Nolan Ryans and Scherzers that could go. There's some young guys that could be that, but we don't let them because we want to protect them. And then we have other guys that shouldn't be throwing 30 innings, and we let them. And so we get this bell curve effect. Some people survive, some people stay in the middle, and some people don't, right? So that's one of the problems. And then the thing is about UCL and stress. Pitching begins as a relatively low intensity movement. You got your lower half, and then you got your trunk, and then you got your shoulder. And during the low intensity part, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and you can still make corrections. But after the foot hits the ground and you start accelerating, it's the fastest movement of any sport, in any body part, in any sport. It's moving so fast. And then in the shoulder, the bones are not really congruent. So there's a lot of things you can do with your musculature to adapt it. But once we get down to the elbow, the bony congruence of the elbow bones, and then the speed at which we're traveling, this stress is inevitable. And the options for adjustment begin to funnel into very few ways that you can do it and still survive, right? And so we got to appreciate that that stress at the end is inevitable. We have to learn to manage that stress. We have to learn to mitigate that stress. And up to now, the solution has been limit the amount of stress, the volume, the frequency, the intensity. But guys are throwing harder. And I think that's probably a contributor. But you're not going to get anybody to throw slower. It's a straw man argument. Like, what are we going to put a cap and say, oh, if you throw it over this velocity, it's a ball? I mean, it's never going to happen. And they're not going to recruit the guys and sign the guys that are throwing 84. They're going to go get the guys that throw harder. So it's going to happen. What we have to do is get better at managing it, leading up to that point, making all the necessary adjustments to prepare the environment perfectly so that when we get to the end, we have created an environment internally that allows the muscles to do their job and protect it. You see, the truth is, JJ, no one knows how much stress a UCL can take because all of the studies were done on cadavers. Mm-hmm. Cadavers aren't alive. And no one knows actually how much stress is imparted on the UCL during a pitch because those are estimates based on inverse dynamics motion capture, which uses sensors that assume the laws of Newtonian physics, like we're made of metal and rivets like robots, okay? So we got this problem with cadavers and robots that we're getting our information from, but we're living human breathing, adapting tissues. And so the information that we got that says it can only handle this much stress, we're trying to limit that and we're headed down the wrong path. And then it was workload 10 years ago and now it's velocity and sweepers. And we just keep doubling down. What we're forgetting about is that the truth is what's happening internally, microscopically at the elbow, at the moment of truth, the little tiny muscle contractions that have to stabilize the joint and protect it, that dynamic stress attenuation is what we have to look at. And we're running into the problem we ran into in Vietnam, right, in the General McNamara. And I'll paraphrase a quote. He said, when you can't measure what's important, you tend to make what you can measure seem more important than it is. In Vietnam War, we didn't know if we were winning because we're not gaining turf. So we just started counting bodies. And that was our way to tell if we were winning. And it was the wrong thing to measure, right? We can see a lot with all biomechanics stuff and the information that we're getting. And I think it's useful, but we have to view it through the lens of, okay, this is important, but it's not the truth. The truth is happening internally. So what we have to do is take a new look at our preparation and our rehab protocols and our recovery protocols and go, how do we create an environment that allows our athlete to explore those stresses at the end that are inevitable? They're going to happen. How do we get them to learn to manage those internally? We can't measure that, right? But how do we create an environment that allows them to turn the muscles on at just the right time? And it's not about strength. It's not about mobility. It's about timing, sequencing, synergy, coordination, the perfect activation of musculature to protect it. And we're not going to get it through rigid top-down or outside-in approaches. It's going to have to be what Alan talks about all the time is self-regulation, self-organization. We got to create an environment where we get them in this place. We let them explore the addition of these stresses, gradually adding to them, and then let their body adapt. And we have to go slow and let their body organize and solve the problem. See, we're thinking that we're smarter than this infinitely intelligent human body. And the body will solve the problem if we can create the environment to make it happen. So I think we have to take a new look at how we prepare because we can help guys throw harder now. I mean, the baseball universe has learned to develop pitchers. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think that the way we develop them, you know, there's nothing wrong with long toss. There's nothing wrong with weighted balls. There's nothing wrong with high velocity throws. It's how we use them. It's the implementation, right? And the way we're currently doing it, it allows us to develop these high caliber ability guys. But unfortunately, I think that our ability to develop our players has possibly outraced what we currently know on how to protect them. And so we have to go, okay, we are looking in the wrong direction at how to protect them. We can no longer go down this road of workload and then double down on this and just keep moving forward down the same path. we have to take a new look and go, maybe there's a different way to look that we can learn to do this. And we're working really hard on that around here. I'm writing a new book about that, about how do we create the environment in training and recovery that allows them to adapt appropriately so their body can handle that inevitable stress that's going to happen. I know that's a long answer, but
Again, these are going to have to be long answers. These are complex questions.
Yeah.
These are complex things that, you know, the industry's been working on for, you know, for decades now. And again, like the thing about it is that that's kind of a perfect jumping off point, which is something you said, Randy, which when I started at VA, the thought process, I would say generally in the industry was that, like you said, that velocity used to be that velocity was either something that you were gifted with or you weren't, right? You either had an arm that a special arm that allowed you to throw 95 because that was back then, you know, really good, or you were an 88 mile an hour guy. But what you could also do was you could develop control, you could develop feel, all of those things were trainable, but the velocity component of it was either something, not that you couldn't work on it and all this, but it either was, if velocity improved, it was probably because you were maturing, you were becoming more physical, you smoothed out your delivery. And then that's obviously flipped, that we now very much know, now here we sit in 2024, that you can absolutely positively increase velocity. And it's something that we have, you know, thousands of examples of pitchers who have made significant increases in velocity because weight training, you know, there are a lot of ways, long toss, there are ways, weighted balls, there are ways to train the body to throw harder than it did. But Alan, kind of, that kind of is the perfect segue to the next thing, which is the part that, that you guys have been working on, which is you all's proposals for changes to essentially return to pitch protocols for pitchers who are coming off of an injury. And I want to ask you about that right after this quick break.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. That's why I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America. It allows me to do everything on one website. I get quality candidates. I can schedule them. I can interview them. I can screen them. I can send messages to them, all within Indeed. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And we're back. So, Alan, with kind of what you all have done now, kind of explain a little bit the background of this. Like, basically what you all are laying out and is available, you know, we'll include a link to kind of the whole package of it. But it's essentially a proposal for a different way for a pitcher to come back post Tommy John surgery, correct?
Yeah, what we did is we figured that since it takes a lot of research and all that, and the medical model's been around a long time, we kind of borrowed a lot from Brittany Dowling's model, who worked with ASMI, and this may have been independent of ASMI, but Brittany and I had some good talks. And so the first 10 weeks, which is essentially a very delicate time, they're just coming out of a lot of rehab in a clinic. And so we are very, very conservative like they are. Our 10 weeks, which is 2.5 months, is quite a long time, you know, are very similar to a lot of the standardized models. What Randy and I really wanted to do is the main models that are out there, other than one, are going to essentially cap the athlete at 120 feet. That 120 foot parameter has been around for 50 years, since 1974. That was the number that was essentially, it wasn't even come up with necessarily as an end all. It was a great quote from Dr. Job with an interview with Will Carroll about how the training facility at Vero Beach where the Dodgers trained and the next closest building was 120 feet apart. And so when they ran out of room, they sent them over to the quote unquote healthy side. And as far as I'm concerned, from, you know, people I've spoken to, that was essentially to continue to train and develop. It wasn't like you're done. We ran out of room. So to give you a little idea, JJ, into where this is going, if you just take a loan that the 120 foot, you know, limitation has been around for 50 years.
How far you throw to just if someone's struggling to understand 120 feet on, you're not going to throw further than to someone 120 feet away, correct?
120 feet is the current parameter for two of the most popular standardized programs out there. And the third most popular one are, I mean, they're all interchangeable. I think caps at 180, but the point is this, 120 feet for us. First of all, that number has been around for 50 years, number one. So that already tells you that's a concern. Number two is if you looked at the prehistory of every single surgery of an athlete, especially an athlete that's 18 and over, I would bet that conservatively 50% of them threw at least 250 feet pre-surgery, because 90 miles an hour at about 35 degrees will go 270 to 300 feet, give or take. Now, I'm not saying everybody's doing this, but we know that that's basically what's
everyone's capable of doing that, you know.
Capable, right. So now we're talking 93 and a half miles an hour. The average fastball now is going to go between 340 and 350 or whatever the numbers are. So there's a massive built-in flaw already with the system that if you're capping players at 120 feet, in some cases, that's 33% of their needs eventually at some point, right? So that's 67% of a lack of what the athlete's going to need. Now, let me tell you what that lack equals. That lack not only equals the distance, but the further you go out, the higher you throw the ball, the more variability, the more range of motion, the more proprioception. Here's another huge thing. The higher you throw the ball, the more you tend to throw with relaxation. We call it massage throwing. And so all of a sudden, it's not that you're just that you're capped at 120 feet and then it's time to ramp you up on a mound when you're, in our opinion, when you're very restricted. And to me, it feels very robotic to get out to 120 feet, unless maybe you're a 10 or 12 year old, right? And so now what happens is our program pretty much picks up at where they stop at 120. And we basically say, look, let's take another month. What's the difference between 9 months and 10, right? Let's take another month. I'll use another term from Will Carroll. Let's let the rehabbing athlete now become an athlete. And for me, Randy, I've talked about this. Let's just let them play. Let them self-regulate, right? give them a chance to start building some distance, building some arc, building some proprioception, building volume and endurance, right? Things that I think are really lacking right now with the problem on the other side, the front side of why arms are breaking down. So let's build some endurance. Let's build volume. Let's build feel. Let's build athleticism. And let's give this athlete a chance to free up. Let's get into the right brain and out of the very linear side of the training, which is very left brain. And so I think JJ really put this in a nutshell, is that month for us is critical. It's the massive piece that is missing with the standardized programs that again are capping these players at a very restricted distance where we feel they're still tight and not developed, and they're getting on a mound to ramp up the mound work to get back to live action. And for us, this month is like 90% of our, yes, there's other things in there that we love and we think are very, very important. But this extra four, it might be 4 weeks, by the way, it might be 6 weeks, and it might be whatever it is, we need the time and space to let the athlete self-regulate and get back into great conditioning, great durability, have great recovery, build great feel. And for us, that is a piece that is missing in these current protocols.
Randy, is it fair to kind of summarize that in some ways, kind of the overarching theme of this, I feel like for you guys, is that not overuse, but volume and intensity on a progressive basis is what you all view as the key to health for a pitcher, not limitation. Again, that's where I feel like kind of when I look at it from the outside is that there was this problem in baseball, which I'm not saying still doesn't exist in some areas of baseball, but where overuse can be an absolute legitimate problem. You don't want a pitcher who's tired, who's worn out, trying to continue to throw. Injuries can arise from that. But we saw that problem, the industry did. And so there was a reaction to that. But maybe, again, what you all seem to be saying is we've gone too far the other way. And especially even when we're talking about an injured player, that the caution, the understandable belief, the concern that we don't want to overuse this pitcher, we don't want to overuse the arm and cause a re-injury, is shifted too far the other way. What's happening is the pitchers aren't being able to get back to what they need to do to be prepared, to be ready to pitch at their best and stay healthy. Is that right, the summation of it?
You nailed it. Absolutely. And back in 2013 or 14, I sat down with Dr. Marcus Elliott, Harvard MD, that works largely in basketball and performance now. But he runs a place called P3 Sports Performance out in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. Brilliant guy. And Marcus said to me, the number one predictor of injury is the delta, the change. Remember in chemistry class, the delta was the change. What we're saying here with this new approach to return to throwing is we're doing a better job of managing the delta. That's what we're talking about. Whatever change we make in training, in development, we're currently probably not making those changes gradually enough, okay? And in the rehab process, the traditional protocol, which I've been given dozens of them in physical therapy practice from the surgeon who says, here's your return to throwing protocol, 25 throws from 45 feet, blah, 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 okay? The first thing that Alan and I noticed is that it wasn't real clear. It's like, okay, how do we actually do this? It's just a set of throws. Like, what kind of throws? How far? How do I get ready to throw? Do the warm-up throws count? What distance? Can I go 46? Do I go straight from 30 to 45 feet, or do I work my way out there? It was really unclear. So we needed more clarity in the current program. The other part was it had no advice for what else to do besides throw. Physical therapists would do their stuff, and then the throwing part. But when did the athlete get back to athleting, right? And so in this protocol, Nunzio Signore has done a great job of providing us a strength training program that can go right alongside your return to throwing protocol that takes a more holistic approach and says, all right, let's do the things that we can do and prepare this athlete so that when this tissue is healed, it can tolerate the stresses and it can use the whole body to attenuate those stresses. And so that was really important. The preparation to throw was really big. Like, what do we do to get ready? And then what do we do to recover after? And Nolan Rappe added a nice little supplement for us on that, on some kinds of exercise we can do to prepare the tissue to accept throwing and then to recover after. And then it was those abrupt changes in the phases that we noticed, that like we went straight from 120 feet to the mound. And it was like, that's a really quick change, right? And so what we did is try in this protocol, that, like Alan said, the first 10 weeks, we didn't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? So the first 10 weeks kind of mimics the traditional program to some degree with those other things added in. And then as we got further out, we needed to make those transitions more gradual. Okay, we needed to kind of add stress incrementally, gradually, managing in the delta all the way. And so we kind of built that into the process to where the phases change more gradually instead of all of a sudden you're doing something different. And then finally, Alan's word is self-regulation. I think it's brilliant. And mine is self-organization. That's from the skill acquisition scientists arena, you know. The body is way smarter than we are, right? The body and we have to get our athletes into an environment where they can attune themselves to the information their arm is giving them, okay? Listen to your arm. Listen to the information you're getting it. Pain is neither good nor bad. Pain is just information, okay? Soreness is not good or bad. It's information. And we look at that and listen to the body and then gradually work your way through the process. And it allows our athletes the freedom to self-regulate within the boundaries of this whole process. Provides about 40 pages of the principles of it that you can use to modify and put into any kind of return to throwing, whether this one's made for Tommy John, but you can use the principles for any injury. And I just want to say, people need to really understand how much work Alan put into this. Like, it was a labor of love. And the hours that he put into researching and talking to people and the collaboration of folks we have, we got a great input from Scott Brown, the Vanderbilt pitching coach, about journaling, right? And he put together this 65 person coalition of some of the most influential pitching guys in the baseball industry. And so the response from them was they were thirsty for this. They were thirsty for a change. They were really ready for it. And again, because of his cachet in the business, everybody tends to have their egos bashing each other. And I know better than you do. But this guy here serving as the sort of connector of all those guys, because of how well he's respected, I've said this before, but he's the only guy in the industry that could have pulled off this kind of, let's get this ship turning in a different direction kind of thing. And so proud to be associated with it.
Well, thank you, buddy.
Kind of with that, where does this go from here? Obviously, you all have presented this now, and it's free. You know, this isn't something where it's like, hey, you know, for $19.99 and $20 a month, you can, you know, do this program. It's literally just available on a website. You can download it all. You can read it all. It's just there available. But I'm thinking of it, trying to think of it from a scientific perspective, which is the way that you all tried to approach this. Okay, are we going to have, like, is there a way to have control, like, to have kind of like, we have a control group, essentially, which is anyone following the normal protocol, but are there now pitchers who are starting to go through this program? Are there, you know, are there ways that we're going to be able to, not for a while, but a few years from now, be able to say, okay, pitchers who followed this protocol have, you know, this much of a success? And again, we could spend a whole nother hour on rate of return. And I know that I've tried to read as many medical studies as I can on this, but I feel like a lot of times they're not even fully encompassing. Like, I want to know more about what a guy looks like before and after the injury than I do about whether he got back for five innings in Double A and he was at Double A before. Because, well, if he's 38, then that may be a success story. And if he was 22, then that's a failure. And they're, you know, the game, but, you know, how are we going to know a while from now, but how are we going to know whether this is a better approach, a better plan than the conventional wisdom? Are there ways that you all are going to be able to gather that information to know that?
Well, number one, Randy just had case study number one started last week. And it's a good point, because we really need to reach out to some of the people in our coalition, especially the rehab or the PT side of it, ATCs, to start gathering data. But Randy alone is going to see, you know, unfortunately, he'll probably see his share of players where he'll have a chance to start to gather data. But I think, JJ, this is just me speaking as a true optimist and speaking from the heart. I just believe at some point, because we've done the medical model for 50 years now, and maybe we don't have a ton of data other than the 93% success rate of return to play based on throwing a competitive pitch right from the previous year at the same level, which I know is one of other studies, but it's one I think that the ASMI has leaned on. And I just believe at the end of the day, I've been saying this a lot lately, and I'll say it again. I truly believe that the real answer is going to come from the baseball side. Not that there's not going to be medical influence from people like Randy, but I think if we keep, as Randy keeps saying, if we keep doubling down on what we've done in the past with these straightforward medical approaches, I just think that we're not making progress, we're not evolving. And I think the proof's in the pudding, as they say, which is, I think time will tell. In other words, our program is free, doing things like this with you as outreach and promoting is massive. But you know, this thing just came out maybe 4 to 6 weeks ago. So I'm still hoping to, as Randy will, you know, meet with some doctors and hopefully, look, we ultimately want to be on the same team, of course, because this is a group effort. But to your point, yes, I know people like data and they're going to want to have case studies. But I also believe this, if people have respect for the amount of work that Randy and I have done over almost 70 years between us, if you look at our coalition of 65 of the people involved with that, right, everyone from Ben Brewster to Kyle Bode to Ron Woolforth, I mean, we can go, you know, Chris Fetter, Drew French. I mean, it's the group, it overwhelms me sometimes when I just look at the people that have, you know, Nate Yeske, Scott Brown, Corey Mascara. It's just already mentioned Nolan Rapay, Nunzio Signori, Tyler White. It gives you that feeling like, wow, there are a lot of people. Randy used the word thirsty before. People are just thirsty for change, JJ. And I do believe at some point that I would like to think that the essence and the substance of the manual and the word of mouth alone is really going to change this paradigm dramatically. But in the meanwhile, Randy's going to be doing his case studies. And look, the more people hear us talk about this and the more they have a chance to see the contrast of what's been out there for essentially 50 years. And look, again, as Randy said, our program, 2.5 months is a long time. The first 2.5 months, we're pretty much in sync with the medical model. We're really just adding in one. Of course, we feel like it's a game-changing piece. But to your question, yeah, that's sort of the bottom line. We feel very, very comfortable with it and very confident that it has a chance to really grow.
There was one thing I did want to segue, because I do also fear, like, I don't want to be saying, again, I'm someone trying to observe this. You all are doing the work, but I'm trying to, as I observe it, when I talk about that overuse has largely been eliminated, I key focus I say of that is on the pro game, and I would even say to a large extent, the college game, and now we at the high school level, those levels, I feel like the overuse component has been much more reduced from where it was. I did want to ask, though, because again, you all are in the, you know, in the trenches on this. Mm-hmm. One thing that always strikes me is, and I'm not picking on any program or anything like that, but like a fear I have is where there is still, and I think of it as even well-intentioned parents and kids, but at the same time, I would say it's not even necessarily a lack of knowledge now as a lack of belief, which is the danger zone that I think we still have in a lot of cases in the U.S. is much more at the very young developing pitcher, the 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, where I would say that the overuse risk in baseball in the U.S. now, in North America, is much more at that level than it is when they get more physically mature, but when they get to the 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, whereas we just talked about, at that point, you're under very strict limits, maybe sometimes too much. I didn't want to talk about this and leave that component out, because I do think it's an important. I think you guys do too. But Randy, like, as you know, I said, you've gone through, you know, this with, you know, in multiple different ways. If you're a parent listening to this, if you're someone who's, if you're a young pitcher, you know, or a pitch, you know, a, a 12-year-old who hopes to pitch in the big leagues one day, what should they also be? Again, you want to be developing responsibly in a way that's going to leave you the best pitcher you can be, but to get you healthy to that point 10, 12, 15 years down the road as well.
Right. That's a great question, too, because we got to look at it in two different models, right? That chronology matters. And I think that, you know, I coached travel ball with three sons for 15 years. I've been in that world. I don't think that people are nefariously overusing. I think we have pitch counts that are there. Some people leak over them once in a while, and there's occasional family that goes to two different teams in the same week or something like that, you know? I think people are aware. I think that one thing that has recently occurred is going to help quell that a little bit is there was a time when college recruiting in baseball had gone down to the eighth grade level, and they were committing kids who aren't driving yet. Right. And so there was this big rush because you had to be at 90 miles an hour by the ninth grade or else you weren't going to get a commitment and you weren't going to go to college. With this new rule they have where they can't speak to the high school player until after their 10th grade, September going into their junior year, they can finally contact the coach. I think that's going to help a lot because now we can slow down. We don't have to rush so much with the young guys. And, you know, we're still always going to have, you know, even though they're not clamoring to get that verbal commitment and get that number on their perfect game profile or wherever, you know, they even though they're not clamoring to get that and get that early commitment, we still have a challenge because there are players that are playing baseball that love to play and want to do really well, right? Baseball is supposed to be fun, right? I agree, everybody's, but it's really a lot more fun when you're good at it, right? It's a lot more fun when you're good. And so these kids are trying to get better. They want to have more fun, so they want to play better, right? But the problem is we got kids who haven't matured yet. And they're facing guys that are shaving and look like they could, you know, drive all the other kids to the game, right? And that's a challenge.
I don't know if there's anyone listening to this who doesn't remember that if you're older from like the kid who matured first, you're like, I do not want to face that kid.
Oh, you know? If they got a mustache, it was like, well, I think that big leaguer should grow like a little 13-year-old mustache because I think it harkens back to that psychological stress you had when you were really intimidating. But like, I don't want to face that guy. He's got a mustache, right? So I call it waiting for Mr. T, and we have to talk to these young guys, and it's really hard because they don't really understand the inner workings of their body. Mr. Testosterone, when Mr. T shows up, as long as we're ready and we prepared your body and conditioned it and you're a great mover and a good athlete, when Mr. T shows up, you'll pass those other people. But we have to have patient persistence. When we rush, we get hurt. And that speaks to the idea of velocity enhancement programs, as you alluded to, JJ. When we first started, they didn't exist. And now there's one in every corner, right? But we can't treat the college senior the same way we treat the seventh, eighth, and sixth grader. You know, we gotta realize that their bodies are different and they can't be on the same kind of program. Okay. So that means you gotta limit it a little bit. And I would say that you try to get the body moving and be as athletic as possible. And of course, use a radar gun once in a while on a young guy just to see where we are as feedback, right? But to chase it at the early age, I think one of the thresholds that we're lacking is we gotta wait till Mr. T has shown up. When you're physiologically ready, then we can really start to push. Let's get your body ready. And then when Mr. T shows up, now we can surge ahead, right? Cool. So we gotta really look at the people that I know, that the people that run training facilities across the country, no one is trying to get anybody hurt. Everyone's trying to do a good job. Mm-hmm. Everyone's trying to help players get better. I think that we have to really get better at appreciating how we have to individualize that training and make sure it matches the player's age and ability and physical capabilities and not rush ahead and, you know, try to go too fast. I think awareness of that is really important. And I think that for parents in travel ball world, it's a pretty simple metric, but we have what we call the one pitch, 1 hour rule, you know, and it's really easy to remember. If you throw 24 pitches, you take 24 hours off before you do it again. I got that from Jill Woolforth, I think. Okay. Back in the day, one pitch, 1 hour. Okay. 48 pitches, 48 hours. And I would say that if I'm a travel ball pitcher and I'm in that tournament that goes Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, if I'm the parent, I would say, listen, you can have my son for the whole game once, but then let's just make it once a week. Let's not have the guy throw Thursday 50 pitches and then Sunday 70 pitches, because while it meets the rules, maybe it's not the best thing if Mr. T hasn't shown up yet, right? So
that's the worry I have with travel. And again, it's not like the travel ball's evil or anything like that, but the worry I have is with it is, the best way I can put it is, because of the dynamics of it, no one wants to be on a travel ball team to sit on the bench the whole weekend, right? So you're not going to have a 25-player roster like we have at college, at pro, at everywhere else. And we want to make sure that everyone gets to play a lot. So we have this very compressed schedule where, you know, where a college team, where a pro team is going to play one game a day, but they're going to play 6 days a week. Right. We have, you know, the understandable, there are a lot of reasons to say, no, we're going to play Friday, Saturday, Sunday, but you may have seven games in those 3 days.
Yeah.
And seven games plus a 14-player roster,
right,
all of a sudden is where it gets a little, that's where it gets, I don't have an easy answer for it, but that's where it can get kind of tricky, can't it?
I coach in that world for a long time. And one thing we always did when we had a 12-13-man roster, because you're right, you couldn't carry more pitchers because they wanted to play, and if they didn't, they just quit. You couldn't keep a team together, right? Everybody needed to play. But one thing we did is we made sure that everyone could pitch. Like, they didn't have to love it. Even the guys that weren't the best at it, I would like, Joey, we need you to pitch, even though you hate it, because we can't have Johnny. You owe it to the team to carry some innings for us, right? And then the other thing that I think needs to change is when you get in tournament baseball, in travel baseball, you're in pool play to start, and everybody wants to win. I'm not saying, you know, it's supposed to be fun. It's fun when you're winning. It's a lot more fun when you're winning, right? And so you have to win all your games in pool play to get to the next stage, which is the playoffs, right? The elimination play. Mm-hmm. But the tiebreaker in pool play in most tournaments is runs allowed, which means even if you have 12 guys on the team that can pitch, you can't afford to give up a run, because that one run might eliminate you from bracket play. And so you end up leaning on the same guys all the time. I think that if we could change that rule to something like run differential, that way, if I'm winning 30-0, I can get Joey in and let him eat up four innings. He might give up 5 or 6 runs. It's okay. You know, we're going to be fine here, you know, and then we can kind of spread the wealth a little bit so that one or three players.
Why don't put you to run scored?
What's run score? Yeah, absolutely.
That way, like, you're there's no danger. As long as you win the game, it's going to be just about how many guns you scored, not how many you gave up, which there is no worry that your cleanup hitter is going to get overused because he hit five homers in the game instead of three.
That's a really good idea. I think that might change the dynamic for us, because then you could afford to develop other guys. You could, and not risk being eliminated and going home early, you know?
Well, okay. So, Alan, to kick it back to you, kind of to wrap this up, we've talked about it. We're going to have a link to it. But if someone wants to, if you're going through this, or, you know, you want to learn more about you all's return to throwing program, how can someone find out more?
Really easily. All they have to do is go to jagersports.com or floridabaseballarmory.com, and it's front and center. All they have to do is click on a link. There's a downloadable PDF if they really want to print it out. And then there's our web guide did an amazing job of setting it up to where you can actually navigate it on our website, to where you can go into the chapter points like reading a book. You can easily go in and out of the different chapter points, because there might be 12 to 15 different sections. And I will say one other thing about that. There's 30 pages, not that it's all written information, there's some graphs and stuff, but there's 30 pages of information before you even start the return to throwing program. And I'm not trying to compare to the other ones, but, you know, I don't know if the other ones have more than a page or two. Maybe in the medical office they're giving them more information, I don't know. But when you print these out when you print these out in general on the internet, you know, there tends to be, some of these are 3 or 4 pages long. And so we have videos, we have graphs, we have a graph from Ben Brewster, as Randy said, we have pieces from Nolan Rapé, Nunzio Signori. So we have supplements, and to answer your question is, it's really easy to find and it is free.
Yeah. And we have a version of it on our website too, floridabaseballarmory.com/RTT, return to throwing RTT. And you can find that there right on the main page of our website, or go to that link. Or you can call us at our really cool phone number, 866-STRIKE-3, which is 866-374-5333. So, yeah. But yeah, I think, and, you know, hey, JJ, thank you for having us on, man. This was fantastic. We appreciate the opportunity to share information.
This was great. Thank you guys for joining us. And thank you all for listening to the Baseball America podcast today with Randy Sullivan and Alan Jager. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, JJ.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.